Welcome back to the Don't Worry About It podcast, where we talk all things mental health related, from anxiety to depression, from happiness to sadness, and all emotions and feelings in between. My name is David Izzo, and I started this podcast to help facilitate conversations related to mental health topics. On this week's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, who is a spiritual director at Chabad of NDG and the Jewish chaplain at Concordia University. Rabbi Bernath is also a dating coach and a matchmaker. He's made 54 matches to date and is lovingly called the Love Rabbi. Now that's how the world knows him. How I know him is a completely different story. We were both on the same Passover program, him as the rabbi, myself working on the catering team. I'd worked my ass off, to be frank, physically and even more importantly mentally. I was at my wit's end halfway through. I didn't know how much longer I could take it. I thought I was going to crack. And I felt like I was on the verge of exploding. Luckily enough, I ran into a stranger, and I just let it all out. All my frustrations, all my anger, anything that was going on, I just needed to let it out, and had a sympathetic ear. As you probably assume, that person was Rabbi Bernath. He showed me an immense amount of compassion and kindness, and just really a sympathetic ear. And if it wasn't for multiple conversations throughout that program, I don't know if I would have gotten through it, and if I would have, I definitely wouldn't have left in as good of a mental state as I did. I'm very grateful to Rabbi Bernath, and I'm really happy I was able to reconnect with him after these many months and to get him come on the podcast. We enjoyed a really, really, really thoughtful conversation. I know, as you'll hear, processed a lot. In the moment, he challenged some really, really intricate ideas and that I held dearly, and still I'm going processing through them. I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Thank you guys so much for listening. Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, welcome to the Don't Worry About It podcast. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's an absolute honor to be here. I feel really privileged to be part of this community.
Yeah, I think the privilege is actually mine. I get a chance to talk with so many different people from so many walks of life, really from any walk of life. And I think your perspective being labeled as the Love Rabbi, and we're going to get into that, as well as being a rabbi of a whole community in the Jewish community right now in Montreal, Canada, dealing with COVID-19 in a whole, I think this conversation is going to bring light to a whole thorough of issues that I haven't been able to go into depth. And somebody with your experience in dealing with those, I think is going to provide a lot of value.
I hope that I can contribute to the conversation.
So my first question is the same question I asked all my guests. I just did a quick intro for you, but I'd like to give you a chance for anything I missed there to introduce who you are to the audience.
I don't know how you exactly introduced me, but for me, I like to say that I'm the rabbi of the people. I like to be very easy to get a hold of. I find that the job of a rabbi is to be with the people, for the people, by the people, to be on the ground and to really listen and to understand what's going on in people's lives. And I find that, I don't know when it happened, but maybe it was somewhere in like that 1950s Judaism, where maybe the synagogues and the rabbis were trying to be more like other faiths, where they put the rabbi on the pedestal away from the people. In my synagogue, I sit in the back of the synagogue. Whoa. And people know that on a Saturday morning, when they come in, the rabbi's in the back of the synagogue, and I make sure to greet every single person that comes in. And I did that from the moment I started.
Wow, I've never heard of that before in my entire life. For those who don't know, the rabbi almost always exclusively sits in the front facing the congregation, and you've taken the approach of sitting in the back with the greeting. How did you come to that decision?
Well, I was never really, I know it sounds strange from a rabbi, but I never found solace and purpose in going to synagogue. And for me, I was always a social Jew. I love people. I love being part of that social atmosphere. And so I said, well, if they're going to put me all the way in the front of the synagogue, then I can't be with the people. So right away when I started, I said, I'm going to be in the back of the synagogue. And I'm sure people are always shocked, because not only am I in the back of the synagogue, but it's like an unknown, it's like an unofficial thing that the rabbi's office on Saturday morning, that people actually sometimes will come to shul, they'll come to the synagogue on a Saturday morning, because they know that they can step into my office, so to speak. It's like the back of the room, and there's two chairs there, you know, one for me and one for the other person, and they can talk to me during the services.
Wow. So you also allow talking to go on during services as well.
I find that faith, tradition is a personal experience. And why should we govern what that experience looks like for you? There's so many different reasons that compel someone to go to synagogue. And people say, oh, Rabbi, I'm really sorry I walked in here with jeans. I said, I think it's a miracle in 2020. I mean, outside of the pandemic, I'm just saying, I think it's a miracle in our society with everything that's going on that someone would actually be interested on a Saturday morning to walk into a synagogue in 2020. I think that is more shocking than anything. So if you're here, I want to honor that. And I want to make sure that that is championed, honored, and purposeful for you, for the purpose of which you came here. I didn't decide. I mean, I wasn't the one who called me to come onto this podcast. The fact that you called me to be on this podcast, and the fact that you're even making this podcast, I think that we have to encourage in our society. And everyone has a reason. When someone walks through the door of my synagogue on a Saturday morning, there's a reason why they came this morning. Because I can tell you, and I'm sure you know, there was a million reasons why not to come.
Yeah, I think you're challenging a system, and I'm sure you've had a lot of pushback on that. But your ideas that sound somewhat unorthodox don't sound, in practice and in theory, that absurd or that wild. I think we take for granted, like you said, the fact that anybody's walking into synagogue in the year 2020. I think that's taken for granted by a lot of communities and a lot of synagogues. They kind of expect that people will come at all times, and not thinking a lot about how can we, outside of what we need to do, encourage and accept people to come in. I think the jeans comment is great. I never understood why communities, but people feel shunned or not allowed in if they're not wearing the right clothing. And I think that there needs to be a modicum of respect. And to a certain extent, I don't think you should walk into a shul in a tank top and shorts. I think that's for me more of a respect thing for what's going to take place and for the community. But if your community is set up of a community of everybody's wearing that type of garb, then I don't think I'd have a problem as much with it. But I think that's a really...
Wouldn't you rather look on what's on the inside than what's on the outside?
I believe the inside matters, but I do think the book cover matters as well. I think taking pride in how you dress and I think there's also a level of respect of...
I would like to say that the person who woke up in the morning on a Saturday and put on jeans wasn't saying, I'm not being respectful in synagogue. That is maybe the best clothing they have. Who are you to judge what their best type of clothing and what they feel connected to at that moment and why they're wearing that clothing? And you know what? Even if they got up in the morning and they were planning, sorry to interrupt you, but even if they were planning on going to the gym and instead they took a right turn and went to the synagogue and they walked in their sweatpants, I think that's a value. That's a value because you get points for showing up in life. I'm not saying that's the end all be all, but you should get points for showing up.
I agree. I actually agree with you. I think where maybe I wasn't being maybe as articulate as I should have been. I think you're right in that sense. Who are we to judge is a question we don't ask ourselves enough of in life. Where judgment is shown, maybe compassion would be better. Would be a better term to go. I think trying to put yourself in other people's shoes and understanding the why. But I also do understand why communities set. There is a reason why communities do set standards. There's a reason why we have certain garbs that we wear. I mean, that there are values in the traditional and systems that we do use. And I always try and show both sides of any argument, regardless of which one I take. And I think you've shown a lot of light into it. But I also think that there is a thing. What if you are somebody who does have access to nicer clothes, and you know that that's what the community does? Sometimes I think there are people who will challenge that by wearing that said clothing just to stick it to a community or a shul. And I think that's where the line starts to get blurred. It's the action.
And if you're angry, you still showed up. It doesn't change the fact that you still showed up. Even if you're angry, I mean, there's so many people who are angry and they don't show up. And I, you know, there's so many choices. And I think that the only thing that we truly have control over are the choices that we make.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, what is a serenity prayer?
Definitely giving me a lot to think about. I've challenged a lot of ideas that I thought, you know, I fully believed in. And I think that's an incredible thing. It's why I do what I do. So I love having conversations with people from who have all different types of viewpoints. I mean, you're the first rabbi that I've spoken to in my life that has ever spoken so openly about these things. And I think that's a big testament on your part. You clearly have a lot of strength in your convictions and your beliefs. And I don't think, and I do believe that you've put in, clearly you've put in yourself out there. And has there ever been, have you gotten any backlash to the way you've structured your shul?
Does it matter?
Yes, it does.
Why?
Because if you're somebody who's gotten backlash and you're somebody who's had to take a lot of fire for the way you've done it, the fact that you've been able to, the ability to stick through with your beliefs under fire from maybe threats of job loss or threats of maybe to you, maybe to your family, there's of course it matters. Somebody who's testing matters. It's why God tests us all the time. It's why we test ourselves. It's why we test others. It matters.
You remind me of the serenity prayer. You know, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. If I'm going to get pushback from someone, it's something I can't change. I can't change what you think of me. I can't change your attitude, your actions, but I can change my attitude and my actions. So I'd rather focus on things that I can change versus things that I can't change.
Sure. And I think the Serenity Prayer is a beautiful prayer. It's something I think about a lot. I've never been in the Alcoholics Anonymous program. I've never had that thing, but I think that that prayer being associated only with that is actually a disservice to the
I agree. And that's why I didn't even bring it up as Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that it goes well beyond that.
I couldn't agree more, but I think the reason why I asked if you've been challenged with it, I think was leading me the way I want to go lead down to is understanding as a rabbi community, you know, rabbis face a lot of backlash and how do you, and dealing with that backlash is the same way any common person deals with any challenge in life. And that's, it can take a mental toll on one.
I want the wisdom to know the difference between the things that I can and can't change. And I've worked my entire life to try to understand, because so often we focus on things that we can't change and they really bring us down. So I would rather focus on things that I can change and they'll lift me up, because I have control over my reactions. I have control over my convictions. I have control over things that I stand for. And I don't have control over, you know, the backlash, over what you think of me or what anyone else thinks of me. I just don't have control over that. So why would I want to go down that road? Why would I want to start entering into that space in my life when I know that it's just going to be a rabbit hole and there's absolutely no way that I can do anything about it? I'm not going to convince you anything different if you're against what I'm saying. But my actions, modeling the proper behaviors, maybe in my actions, you will see something different and it'll allow you to question your own convictions.
Is that how you've always believed, or is that something you've grown to take on?
I think that I've always believed it. I just, over the years, I've created a method to my madness.
Can you elaborate what your method of madness is?
You know, the foundation of relational psychology is this Venn diagram between self, myself, other, let's say you, and this thing that they call thirdness. And I never had the words to be able to describe it until I understood the elements of relational psychology, where this thirdness, so often there are people who are trying to convince someone of someone else, of something else. So they'll go from me to thirdness, but it's not about you. If you want to truly be relational, if you want to truly understand the dynamics of what a relationship is, it's about a real connection between me and you. The thirdness is the, maybe could be the element of connection, but I am not going to convince you of anything. I am not going to, for me to debate you and the two of us to come out saying, oh my gosh, that was an amazing debate, Rabbi. I think I'm going to change my life. And even people, you know, and I've had the privilege of people who have made huge changes in their life. And I always say, I'm in awe of you, but I don't understand you. I mean, is your life that bad that you could do an entire 180? I think people who are raised in a secular home and they become more religious, like, is your life that bad that you have to make a full 180 in your life? Or the opposite, people who are raised in a religious home become secular. So I see people doing it. I see people making these life changes, but I don't understand it.
You brought up something that I didn't realize I didn't realize I understood until recently, and that's the idea of when you make change, right? There are times, right, when you say I got to make something goes wrong, and we immediately say we need to make a massive change in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the questions that you ask are really important. Why? Why do we have to change everything? Why do we have to do a full 180? What was I doing? Even if you're somebody who's messing up a lot in life, you're probably doing at least a few things right.
I would say so.
Just by probability chances, you're probably doing a few things right. Now, there are things that we do need to change. Right. Habits, maybe. Time spent. Values. There are things that we can change. But I do think understanding and not saying we need, I think, when you go from one seismic change to another and you do a 180, then you're just an extreme on the other side. You just end up taking the opposite views of what you believed, and you haven't actually maybe necessarily even challenged or understand why you believe what you even believe.
Yeah, it's very powerful. I don't know why this is coming to my mind, but sometimes I'm just gonna broadcast this, and I may regret telling the story, or maybe I won't. I don't think I've ever told this story publicly, but right after I became a rabbi, my first position, somewhat of an internship, is I worked for an organization that visited army bases and prisons all over the United States. It's called the Aleph Institute. And I went to something like, I don't know, 44 or 48 federal prisons over the course of a year. It was an amazing experience. And I don't want to go into all the details of that, but one particular prison I came to, the chaplain on staff told me that there was a man there that was on death row. Would I like to meet him? And he was Jewish. So I said, look, my job as a rabbi is to visit, you know, as many prisoners as I can. I often saw Jewish and non-Jewish prisoners, but often they would make sure that I saw the Jewish prisoners. I said, look, if he's a Jewish prisoner, I want to see him. He said, well, you understand he's on death row. I said, okay. I mean, maybe I was a little naive. I was young, my first, you know, right out of rabbinical school. I was altruistic to a certain extent, excited. And so I come into the room where we're going to meet, making a long story as short as I can to get to the point. And they have a telephone and a glass. And I said, I didn't come 400 miles to speak through a phone. If I wanted to speak through a phone, I would have called him. I want to sit with him in person. He said, well, you know, this guy has been in solitary for 3 months and you're the first person he's seeing. We don't trust him. And I said, well, figure out a way. Anyway, they buzzer me up from head to toe. I mean, if I went and ugh, 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 I would get, you know, the whole place would be all buzzered up. And finally, I'm sitting there. There's a metal table, and I'm sitting at this wooden chair. And he was going to come in, and they bring him in from the other side, and he's in a dark green jumpsuit, and he's chained with his arms and chained with his legs, and the guards chain him to the floor, and they chain him to the table, and he's sitting there with his head down like this. Just sitting there with his head down. Now, I wasn't sure what I was going to say to a guy on death row. Like, have a nice life. Like, what do you say? And I called a rabbi friend of mine who was an experienced prison chaplain. And I asked him what to do. And he gave me a really good idea. Anyway, so I start talking. The guy is not making a move. His head is down. He's not even grunting. Not a move. And I'm talking literally a monologue to myself. There's no reaction from this guy. This is going on for about 10 minutes. And like, I'm looking at the guards who are looking at me. I'm like, I don't know what to do with him. Like, you know, what do you do with this guy? He's not even responding. And then I remember his name. I'm calling him a different name. I don't know what his story is now. I'll call him John. So John, I just want to tell you one thing before I leave here today. I want to tell you that you're a righteous person.
Well,
all of a sudden, his eyes lift up. I'll never forget those eyes. They pierce my eyes like daggers. And in this very low voice, he looks at me and he says, "Rabbi, I've been called many things, but never have I been called righteous." So I said, "John, you're probably wondering why I'm calling you righteous." And he shakes his head and nods his head in affirmative. I said, do you know how many commandments there are in the Torah, in the Bible? And he shakes his head, no. I said, there are 613. Do you know how many of those commandments are positive and how many of those commandments are negative? And he shakes his head, no. And I said, there are 248 positive and 365 negative commandments. I said, "John, when was the last time you stole?" "Rabbi, I'm in the hole." "When was the last time you murdered?" "Rabbi, I'm in the hole." "When was the last time you committed adultery?" "Rabbi, I wish, I'm in the hole." I said, "By doing nothing, John, you do most of the commandments, and that makes you righteous."
Wow. That's a powerful, powerful idea. How did you come to decide that this was going to be your monologue?
I had called a rabbi mentor of mine, and he had kind of given me the core idea. And I've thought about this moment so much. I mean, we ended up having an incredible 2-hour conversation after that, I mean, went into so many different things, and he opened up about his life and different elements. And I don't know whatever happened. I wasn't allowed to know what happened with people. I don't know if they ever killed him or what the story was, but here was a man on death row, and here was an opportunity to find merit. And I wasn't there to look, I'm sure there are people who would be upset at me because he probably did some terrible things. You don't get to death row because you're a saint, but there's got to be something good. And even it's such a profound part in my life that here is a man who does nothing and he's doing most of the commandments. And I think that is the way that God set this up for us in the Torah.
By doing nothing, you are doing something.
By doing nothing, not only something, you're doing most of the 613 commandments. There could have been more positives than negatives.
Right. And God understands, and we believe, right, that God must have understood.
I mean, there must be some compassion in all this insanity, right?
And I think compassion is something that, you know, that we talk about, that we need to have more. And I think still somehow it's undervalued. You know, compassion is something that's brought up so often in life, especially in teaching kids, you know, yeah. Have compassion for others. We hear it all the time. And
it's,
I still,
it's an overused word. No one really knows what it means, compassion.
It's an overused word and it's an underrated action.
I agree.
The power that compassion has. And listen, it's easy to say about having compassion on people that you like, that are in your life. It's easy to say have compassion for a stranger that you don't know. But having compassion for somebody who's on death row, having compassion for somebody who's, like you said, they're not in there for good deeds. And who knows what really went on, but in those times, there, it's even harder to do it for those people. And I just think, obviously, if you're the family members of people who've, you know, whatever, victims of people who do commit absolute heinous crimes and end up there, I understand why. And I don't say, I wouldn't tell them ever to have compassion for him. But there does need to be a way. I'm a big believer in redemption. I believe that there has to be a pathway back.
I think that redemption is something that the Jewish people gave to the world. I think about so many different values that the Jewish people gave to the world that the world doesn't even acknowledge that were ours, Like, for example, there's no other source for a 7-day week besides for the Bible, for the Torah. Right. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. There's nothing else. I mean, it's not a cycle of the moon or a cycle of the sun like other types of days and months are moon, years are sun, but weeks are biblical. And we gave that gift to the world. I mean, in the beginning, when we were taking off one day, they were like, you lazy bums. What are you doing? And today, I don't know, does anybody work a day anymore?
Well, I mean, now you see companies actually even in, companies are now starting to implement 4-day work weeks.
Yeah. I mean, so redemption is one of those values. It's one of those values. The idea, I mean, I always think about Martin Luther King Jr. getting up and giving that, you know, Memphis, Tennessee, giving that famous mountaintop speech. And he quoted Moses. And every time I hear that, I'm like, why don't you get your own person? Like, there's gotta be some great black person who you can speak. Why are you using my Moses? Like, use your own Moses. There's gotta be some person. But I think what we proved, and one of the reasons why Passover is so popular and it's for the ages, is we proved that you can be enslaved and freed in a single generation. And that's powerful. And so every person, every peoples that have been enslaved have looked at us and said, if they can do it, so can we. And that's why Martin Luther did that.
And I think the idea of, I think the idea can be individualized. I think that very often, I know I'm a huge victim of it, is of enslaving my own self to my own mind sometimes, to my own mm-hmm. self-doubt, to my own self-pity, to my own basic self-fulfilling prophecies of you're not enough, you can't do this, you're not, I made a huge mistake, I did something that I shouldn't have done, and then it takes me a long time to get over it on my own, but let alone that own self-forgiveness. And I think when you can forgive others, and you can then maybe one day, hopefully, you can show that same compassion. It's kind of, you know, they say treat others as you'd want to treat your own self. Well, what if you're somebody who treats others really well? Why don't you treat your own self as well?
Or what if you're someone who treats yourself terribly? Do you want to treat them like you treat yourself? Right. I mean, that's an arbitrary statement. I'd rather give people redemption, give people the benefit of the doubt, use a certain level of values in that conversation.
Yeah, I think that actually is a greater leads to all these ideas, and the inability to do these things, I think, causes a lot of strife in people's lives. I think it causes a lot of grief. I think it can cause a lot of struggle, not only yeah. within their own interpersonal relationships with others, but their relationship within them, their own selves. And I think the relationship that we have with ourselves radiates and impacts and absolutely reflects onto the relationships we create with others, whether that be in a personal relationship, whether that be a relationship with family members, or on a greater level, finding your connection, your one, you know, if you want to call it the one, your husband, your wife, whatever it is, however it is that you phrase it, I think that ultimately stems from those other relationships that you create.
Yeah, it's powerful. Something to think about.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've been, I don't know if you were self-redeemed or where you got this label as the love rabbi. How did that come to be?
It was just I never imagined that this would be a main part of my rabbinate, this idea of relationships and helping people with their relationships. I came to Montreal 15 years ago and I saw that Montreal was a little, I said, you know, I felt like I was coming from the future. I saw the melting pot of the United States and how so many young Jews were marrying out of the faith, and so many young Jews were not interested in marriage. You know, aside from the intermarriage issue, I always say that marriage has to be an issue, because today people aren't getting married. And so I started talking about marriage, and I was this young, altruistic rabbi, all excited and passionate. I was married, I don't know, like a year at the time. What did I know really about marriage? But I started talking about marriage. And then people started coming to me and saying, you know, maybe you can set me up with somebody. Maybe you know someone that I can go out with. And I'm like, I don't know how to set somebody up. Like, okay. So I started doing that. You know, I started playing matchmaker a little bit. And one thing led to the next. And I was, you know, at this point, like this week, I set up 34 dates.
Wow.
But about 5, maybe 6 years ago, Montreal's biggest French newspaper did a whole expose on me for one of their weekend editions in February around, you know, that love holiday. And they called it Le Rabbin de l'Amour, which means the love rabbi, but sounds so much better. And so when the English newspaper did a different expose, they called me the love rabbi, but Le Rabbin de l'Amour sounds so much better.
Oh, that's amazing. That's an unbelievable, that's such a great, great title.
So, yeah, I mean, so that's how the moniker was created. I hate it, but I've just learned to live with it because I think it's cheesy, but just learn to like, just live with it. Look, if it's going to help people, call me whatever you want. Call me dude, call me late for dinner. I don't really care.
Right. No, it's interesting that this is, you know, when I challenged you earlier, you know, I said, doesn't matter. And now this clearly is something that, you know, you can see, I don't know, bother might not be the right word, but you seem to reflect on it. And
well, it's not a core value. Like what you call me is not a core value of mine. So I'd rather focus on things that are important to me and save things that aren't important for somebody else.
Absolutely. So you kind of, you know, you come to Montreal, you start talking about marriage by happenstance. I mean, I don't necessarily believe it by happenstance. I think that kind of just, probably something you were interested in, passionate about, something that you wanted to talk about. And then here we are 15 years later and I'm much to my parents who were both born and raised in Montreal, chagrin, I can't speak French. I can't say it the way you will. So forgive me, but I'm going to, this love rabbi kind of concoction just comes out of just an ability to just kind of talk about these things like were clearly reflected in, impacted on people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And now, yeah, I mean, I've traveled the world talking about relationships with Zoom. I can travel the world from the comfort of my own home. And yeah, it's totally never imagined, definitely never imagined this, but I will take it how it comes. And if it can help people, I'm there.
So now I've got to ask a few questions just on my own, you know, kind of ideas of what's missing? What are people, you know, people aren't getting married at the same rate that they used to be. What's going on in the state of modern, at least in the modern Orthodox or Orthodox Jewish religion? Why, and if you want to talk about greater, maybe greater in the world as well, that's fine. But what's going on? Why are we struggling to connect and to marry?
I'm not a therapist. I'm only someone who is on the ground talking to people. So I can only tell you from my experience. But I think that we're missing role models. Years ago, there were so many things that were obvious, that there were innate. And there were particular reasons for it. There was one, I mean, the young woman wouldn't be able to leave the home until she got married. Today, it's not that way. Today, young people are choosing career over relationship. And I don't think they can both be the main part of your life. They can't be the most important thing in your life. You can't have two lifelong things, life goals that are that big to be the most important thing in your life. Today, people they don't see the value in it. I mean, the divorce rate is over 50%. The odds of staying married are much less than the odds of getting divorced. There's a lot of people who come from divorced homes, so they never saw what a happy marriage. And there's people who come from married homes, but their parents aren't happy, or they don't model. They don't want to see themselves in their parents' relationship. That's not for them. So we have a problem where this generation just doesn't see the value. And frankly, when you can have, you know, when you can milk the cow without buying it, as they say, right? Isn't that the terminology they use?
It's not one that I've used.
Okay, that's what I've heard.
So I wouldn't know.
Yeah. So then there you go. I mean, you know, there's no reason to. It's funny because I've been working on a book now. I'm almost done, and it's called Why Bother Getting Married. And it's basically my case for marriage in the 21st century, because and I go through the whole my process of really trying to understand this, because I come from a vastly different world. I was raised in a very religious world. I got married when I was 22. I never went through this, but in the past 15 years of being a rabbi of a secular young community, I have lived vicariously. So I, through these people's relationships and non-relationships, and I've listened to the loneliness. I mean, can I tell you about the loneliness that I've heard in the past 6 months of the pandemic? It's so shocking. And because I come from such a different world, I find that maybe I bring a different perspective because it's not obvious to me as it is for everyone else. I don't just accept the status quo. I never accept the status quo in my life. So I question it and I wonder about it. I think there's a lot of people who have expectations and they're married to their expectations and not to an individual.
Expectations, but not individual. Interesting. I mean, I'm somebody, I won't, just out of respect, I won't go into detail, I refuse to go into great detail about it, just out of respect for my own parents. I'm somebody who's, I'm 25 now, but my parents got divorced when I was 15 or 16 years old, you know, and when you talk about modeling relationships, and I think back to what people talk about marriages were supposed to be, and then, you know, they're, unfortunately, I blacked out parts of my childhood. There's things that I do remember, things that I don't remember, and also memories aren't always the greatest. Aren't always the greatest accuracies. There are a lot of the times based off what we, you know, think they were and they recreate. But I think when you talked about role models, I think that can be a big one. I know the people who grow up, you know, watching those relationships, and I always remember, you know, looking stock at thinking back to my own parents' relationship and then to, you know, relationships of friends' parents or others that I'd see, and I'd be like, oh, that's something that, you know, that I want. And I looked at things in my own parents' marriage and was like, those are things that I want, those are things that I don't want. And right there, I just used the right word, expectations. You know, we have expectations for what we want, for what we think that we want. And unfortunately, we're not that accurate in our own assessment of what we need or what we should have. And even if we know better, we still make the same mistakes. So
people come up with this laundry list of things that they want. And I ask them the same question, can you be married to this person?
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
It's huge, right? I mean, just saying, the person who you are today, can that person be married to the person you want? I just want to know. Can you get along?
I think it changed, right? There are so many things I think that go into variables of it, right? Can I marry you today? Yeah. What about, you know,
I'm not asking you to marry the person today, but I just want to know if you're looking, if these are really your non-negotiables, then.
Oh, okay.
If this is really your non-negotiable, this is really your list. I'm assuming if you have a list, it's your list of non-negotiables, obviously. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with looks, which are not here or there. They're not the answer for a 50-year relationship. That's for sure. I don't know about 50 years, but I can tell you about 15 years.
Right.
You know, people change, experiences change, things change. What are you looking for? When you're looking for a relationship, are you looking for all these little things? Is that really that important? Well, then I have a good idea. You know, there was somebody who literally came to me with the list last week. And so I said, I have a very good idea for you. I said, I'm going to take your list and I'm going to put it into Google. And I put it into Google and I pressed images. And surely enough, a number of pictures of women come up. I clicked on one of the pictures. I said, I have a very good idea for you. Let's blow this up, this picture. Let's make a full size version of it. Let's put it on a cardboard. We'll make a full cardboard cutout, and then I'll marry you to that cardboard to the cardboard cutout.
That's one way to get your point across. It's a very good one. But I think the idea that looks don't matter at all is not one that. Are you saying that looks aren't a factor?
Looks are very important, especially for men. I just don't want it to be the first thing. I'd rather you have one value that's more important than looks, because it's not the sorry about that.
No problem.
I don't know how they got through. I turned my phone off.
Technology,
yeah. I think that I'd like you to have one value that's more important than looks. And I'm not saying no looks. I'm just saying don't make it number one.
I would agree. I mean, I would agree with you. I think a lot of people, at least that I talked to in my friend group, I mean, most of my, for the most part, a lot of my really good friends, I'm 25, are at the age of 24, 25. Some got married so young at 20, 21, 22. You know, when I asked them, we'd speak about like relationships, a lot of them, you know, looks wasn't the first, usually wasn't the first part. I mean, at least when we, I remember back when I was studying abroad in yeshiva, that when we had like the talks with our rabbi, you know, the big thing that I always took away was there were three major components that he had mentioned to us. One where, you know, you have to be on the same page religiously with your religious values, right?
You need or any kind of values and any kind of non-negotiables.
Right. We separated religious, like just your religious beliefs. And if you're somebody who's not religious, then that is different for you. And you have to be on the same page there, I think, as well. But also, you know, then the second one was, you know, your philosophy on life and how life should, and how you view life, right? What are the things that you value in your life? What do you want in your life? Those should match. And then the third was looks. Now everybody ranges those differently, but I think the important part is if you kind of play the mismatch, if we have one but not the others, or two but not the others, which one's kind of more important? And I think looks, at least for me, usually fall into the third in hierarchy. I think it's all thresholds, to be honest, with looks. The person needs to be attractive enough. We know, as we've learned, I'm also not a professional, but just somebody who's grown up and has been experienced in his conversations with others, the thing that comes back to, at least for men, is we all kind of agree, personality changes the way the look is, right? The girl just has to be good looking and has to look good enough initially to start the conversation. But when you get to know them and you're on the same page and you have the same value and you have fun, you laugh, whatever it is that you do, the looks change. You start to look at them differently. And that basis that may have been saying, I think they just fit under the threshold of like looks that I'd go out with, 3-4 months later could be like, she's the most attractive person in the world to me.
I'll never forget, there was a guy that I set up with this young woman, and he said, like, I he was going out with her. He's like, I can't stand her nose. So I said, okay, look, I'll talk to her. So I spoke to her, and she said, yeah, I also have something, you know, my nose is whatever. I don't mind after we're married, you know, if that's really non-negotiable for him, then I'll get a surgery. Anyway, they get married, life goes on. 2-3 years later, they're sharing the story with me, and I thought it was just so profound. So they had a kid, and afterwards, you know, she decided that they're not going to have, you know, any children for her. So she goes over to him and says, I think I can get the surgery now. Like, I promised you before we got married, I'd have the surgery. And he's like, no, I love your nose. Why would you change that?
That's unbelievable. The thing that was a potential deal breaker and saying, and also the way she leveraged it by saying, after we get married, I'll take care of it. Not before, but after.
But I mean, she was being true to her word.
Right.
But and that's what's so beautiful about it. And that's what love is. Love is something that grows over time. It's not this instant thing. I mean, if you want an instant relationship, look at the movies and get your marriage advice from the movies, because you have the beginning, the middle, and the end of the relationship in 2 hours. So if you're looking for a 2-hour relationship, then you can get all your advice from the movies, which unfortunately, since we don't have good role models, a lot of people are getting a lot of their relationship advice from the movies.
Absolutely. I mean, I think back to it, I'm somebody who enjoys a good rom-com. Lose points for this one for saying that out loud, but I'll say it and I'll own it. And I think that the damage that has done those rom-coms, and thinking that you see a relationship in 2 hours and not understanding, you know, what else goes into a relationship at that in those 2 hours that you're sitting in the movie theater is everything. That's where the relationship's actually made. It's in the montages, right? It's always the, you know, I always think about it, and I remember talking with a few friends about this one time. You know, whenever that person's in the existential crisis, right? The breakup happens, and the sad music comes. The guy or the girl go to everyone's got this. I don't know how they do, but everyone's got their special place overlooking a river or the top of the mountain. I'm like, they don't even show you how long it took them to get to the top of the mountain. It's like, by the time you even get there, you probably did all your deep thinking anyway. But everyone's got that part, and I remember thinking, like, not everything's solved by a mountaintop. They never show you the times they go there, and they like doesn't work. Right, you go to have those profound thoughts, and you're going to come to that conclusion that this is the person and all that stuff. It's like there's in those 2 hours, there's months and a ton of time of just absolute messiness.
Absolutely.
And one thing I'm curious to hear about, you know, I think this all plays into the discussion of mental health. I think the strains that people go to in and the immense loneliness that I think our generation is feeling, especially that's only been amplified by COVID-19. COVID has changed everything. It's really hard to go, even just to go out on a first date, your options are now limited.
I want to say something that COVID changed everything. It changed everything right now. But I do believe that life will get back to normal and we will all forget this.
Really?
Yes.
I couldn't disagree more.
I think that we're all going to forget this because that's just human nature. We forget things. And I think that if we don't, while we're in it, it's the way it is. When you're in a crisis, you think the whole world's going to end, but then you just forget it. I mean, I always say to couples who are going through difficulties in their engagement, you know, preparing for the wedding, I say to them, you're never going to remember this time in your life. They're like, how is it possible? It's so emotional. It's so raw. It's so real. There's so much going on. I said, you're never going to remember this point in your life. It's so real and raw for you right now, but eventually it's just going to be a dim puff in the blaze of your life. Now, COVID is like that. If we don't take a step back now and think about it and say, how is this going to change me when it's all over? If we don't start that change now while we're in the crisis, it's not going to last. And we will forget about it and we'll go back to the way we were. If we really think that something needs to change as a result of this, that COVID changed everything, I'm happy for that. But then COVID should change everything and we should start that change now.
100%. I think a lot of things that were implemented during COVID are going to change things. I think masks have done a lot in terms of just facial recognition, seeing people's expressions, their faces, seeing a friendly face, walking down the streets of New York City and seeing someone smile, seeing someone get pissed off. You know, that is in New York, somebody lives in New York, that's like a staple, right? Seeing all that anger and whatever it is, but there is something about seeing faces. I think that those things are going to linger. I do think when we look back, we flip the chapters a 10, 15, 20 years ahead, I think we're going to look back and we won't remember the raw and emotional feelings that we felt as intensely today. But I do think it's going to impact the way that we, and I think you're absolutely right when you said it, I think the change does need to start now, the evaluating of what matters, if I was reliant on something that, and then COVID kind of unmasked it, that there's that problem was most likely there before. Some problems they weren't, right? Some people just had their entire lives up overturned. Some people lost family members that changed their entire family dynamics. Some people lost a lot and I'm very curious to see when, God willing, this whole thing kind of ends, what's going to happen? What lessons did we learn? How quickly do a lot of people just go back to?
I think that let's learn the lessons now. That's going to do much better for us and for the world.
Right. And I think, you know, just to kind of bring it back to how COVID, I mean, it's hard. My father's in the wedding business. He's been in the catering business for 30 years. He's now working at a wedding hall that's doing a lot of weddings in New Jersey. You know, I ask him a lot of the time about what it's been like dealing with it. And for a lot of people, it's caused a lot of stress, the unknown. And that's where a lot of anxiety is built in, right? The fear of the unknown. It's kind of changed things. And I think if you're, and I also think back to kids, especially my age, 25, single, it's a lot easier for guys than it is for girls. And I think for girls, right, that are at that age, they've been spending a lot of time, whether they had to move out of their apartments because of COVID or for a lot of reasons, they haven't been able to go on dates. And you know, for them, time seems to fly a lot faster in terms of what they've been told or what is real, what isn't. Some people say it is, some people say it isn't, but I think that's also has to play a huge mental toll in a lot of people's relationships, just trying to get married.
Absolutely.
What have you been seeing in terms of, and what advice would you give?
With regards to which part?
With regards to how to navigate, if you're somebody single, and you're trying to get married or you're trying to date just for the purpose of marriage, like, well, how does one navigate these insane times?
Well, I think that first of all, you have to ask the question is how does someone navigate, period? Forget about insane times.
You know what? That's a much better question. How does in normal circumstances or any circumstances?
Yeah. I mean, then once you understand how to navigate, period, then you can actually start talking about how to navigate in uncertain times. And that's, I think, with anything in life. If you don't know where you're going, you're just going to be on a joyride. I mean, sometimes joyrides are nice, but not always.
Right.
So I think that to simplify a very complicated thing, I think that we need three people in our life while we're dating. Three people, and I say this to the exclusion of all others. Dating is not a survey. It's not something you just go and ask all, oh, this one or that one or the other one for advice. It's a lifelong thing. And I'll add to that by saying the people who say, oh, I know it's the right person for me in 5 minutes. Did you decide your career in 5 minutes? Did you go to university for 5 minutes? Anything important in your life, did you know in 5 minutes? So you have to allow the process to happen, but you need three people in your life to allow that process to happen. You need someone whose job is to push your match. I would call a matchmaker or somebody who is a suggester, someone who's pushing you and saying, hey, David, get out of your comfort zone and go out, do it. And they're always pushing that match. You need a mentor, somebody who you can be vulnerable and real with, who you will, if they're not a survey, they're not a good idea, you will listen to their advice, and a friend, somebody who's on the equal level as you, that you can just kind of bounce off ideas. And the job of the mentor is to give you advice, and the job of the friend is just to spit back what you said so you can hear yourself out loud. The friend should not be a mentor, and the mentor should not be a friend.
And there's a thin line there.
There's a huge difference. Now, it could be that the person who you think is your mentor is really your friend, and the person you think is your friend is really your mentor. That's fine. And it could be that one of those is your dad. That's fine too. But your dad can either be your friend or your mentor. There's not a fourth person called your dad or your mom. And every single person who's in that role needs to know what their role is in that space. And most importantly, nobody should ever be making the choice for you. It's your choice, whether you're wanting to get into a relationship, whether you're in a relationship and it's not going well, nobody should ever make the choice for you. So many people are just saying, just tell me what to do. No, that's not how you ask for advice. No one should be telling you what to do. If you want, maybe I'll give you the right questions to ask yourself so you know what to do. If you want, maybe I will give you a perspective from someone who's been there and done that or seen other people do that. I can tell you what other people have tried. But no one should be telling you what to do. And I think that those three people are the key factors in starting and going into a long-lasting and healthy relationship.
So number one was the match, was a shadchan, a matchmaker, somebody to set you up.
Somebody who really thinks the greatest thing that happened since sliced bread is getting married. They have to really, truly believe in it. And they have to be good at it. I mean, there's also, there's a skill to matchmaking.
Which is? I appreciate what matchmakers do and what shadchanim do. I'm a little skeptical of what it is. I think
you have to know there's a skill to it. If you make one or two matches, then I would say it's a good guessing game and you just throw darts at the board and see what sticks. But I just had my 68th engagement. It's not a guessing game.
Exactly. It's a magic, but it's like a magic show, right? You know that somebody's, for me, I always look at it. Yes. I think it's my own issues, but it's like a magician. Like I can't do what they do, and they're doing something. They're fooling me. And I feel like they're fooling me, but at the end of the day, they're just doing something that I can't do.
Yeah. Right.
They're doing something. There's clearly something that it's not luck, right? That's the best part of that process.
It's not luck. It's just misdirection. Well, that's a very bad example when it comes to matchmaking.
No, right.
Matchmaking is not misdirection, but I understand like where you're going with this is I think that there's a skill to it. I mean, that could be a whole different conversation. You know, one of the things that I think is that we need a matchmaker training institute and there's a lot of people who are well-intentioned, but they don't know what they're doing. And so they're messing up the process for a lot of people. And that's a whole different conversation in the Orthodox world.
For sure. But what are your thoughts then on organic meetings?
I think that's the best way. If you really want to, I mean, it, and again, the best person is somebody who knows you and is a friend of yours and could say, this is good. That's just a gesture. There needs to be somebody else who they now give it over to, and their job is to push the match. And they need to believe that the greatest thing that ever happened since sliced challah is getting married.
You keep using the word push. It's an interesting word. It's an interesting word to use.
Well, yeah, I mean, because there's so many things that are, you know, somebody once told me that the thing that holds up the Brooklyn Bridge kills most people, and that's stress. In life, there's always going to be a stress of some sort. And I think that there is someone who needs to create that stress. And then the other person in your life can help decipher it. But if you don't create the stress, then you're kind of missing the elements of how it's going to work and how it's going to last. Do you hear all the construction all around me?
Listen, the same way this podcast is life's happening all around us.
Life is happening. I grew up in the streets of Chicago, and we used to play a lot of basketball, and we always said, play with the court.
Exactly. At the end of the day, I think that's controlling kind of goes full circle here, right? The Serenity Prayer. Control what you can control.
That's it.
Let go. Okay,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, and I'm not sorry at the same time.
With the construction. I mean, listen, unless you're that great of a man, you could orchestrate this whole thing.
Being that I live in Canada, and you know, Canadians are very good for saying I'm sorry. I had to say I'm sorry at least once in this podcast.
God forbid we break a stereotype.
Exactly. God forbid.
No, I haven't been offered a jelly donut yet, but
a bagel, you mean? Montreal bagels.
Montreal bagels, the be end all and end all. My father there was never a trip my father took to go visit his mother in Montreal when we go up, but he didn't come back with them.
Absolutely.
There's Montreal bagels.
Très important. Very important. Absolutely.
That's important. So, you know, if you're hearing about, you know, a lot of people nowadays, I don't know, you're more the expert than I am, but there are a lot of efforts that kind of go on. I think, you know, you're talking about friends, who people who know you best and set you up. And I also look at the other side, where there are a lot of people where you hear common, where they go, especially when they get newly married, they go, you're single. The guy's a friend that's single. The girl's a friend that's single. They just go, oh, you're too single. Just go out.
Just go out. Like, you have a nose and she has a nose. Just make it work.
And they'll use the same reasoning that somebody who's pushing will do. Like, the logic and the reasoning is the same. It's just totally based off different things, right? They'll say, give it a chance. You're being too picky. You're being too this. You're being too that. That happens all the time. But when it comes from it's just hard to separate from the professional to the, you know, the.
So even though I'm saying, and I'm talking a big talk about the professional, I think that it's really important when you, from a singles perspective, you just say yes to everything, because they're not asking you to go to the chuppah. They're just saying, are you interested? And then, I mean, it used to be you have to actually spend money on a cup of coffee. Today, you can just do it on Zoom. It doesn't even cost you anything. It's unbelievable.
Right.
And I say, just try it out. I mean, put yourself out there. You got to be a little vulnerable if you want to make something happen in your life. So put yourself out there and try it out. The worst thing can happen is it will be a waste of an hour of your time. Ooh, hoorah. Like, you know, fine. You didn't get to watch your favorite episode or something, you know, who cares? But you got to put yourself out there. Nobody said, I want you to go to the chuppah with this person. They just said, I want you to see if there's anything there. And after your first date, you can just go and say, is there something there that will lead us to a second date? And then after the second date, am I still interested to lead me to a third date? Stop skipping the process. There's a process to this. It may take you 10 or 15 or 20 steps in the process, or 30 or 40. I don't know how long it's going to be. But allow the process to happen. Don't start thinking on step one, am I ready for step 40?
Right. But while all that being said, the goal of going on that date is to get to step 40.
Yeah, but don't...
You have to balance those two thoughts.
Don't... Yes, it's true. I mean, obviously, you don't want to... Yeah, there is a destination, but you're doing yourself a disservice by trying to jump to the destination before you go through the process.
Right. Right. If you don't... if you don't let the process happen, you think too much toward, you have to think towards the end goal, right? The overarching question, I mean, I don't know if you have to ask, some people, I don't think you have to ask it after every tape, but at some point the question has become, is this somebody I can spend the rest of my life with?
Eventually. I
mean, not can.
Eventually. Can I? But today, and after step one or step two or step three, is it is someone I want to see again? That's right. The question.
Right. Do I want to know? Right. The question
when you know he's going to propose, or you're ready to propose to her, then you have to start asking those existential questions. Don't ask it when you first meet the person, or don't ask it. My worst is, you know, it's like always, oh, I got to marry a Jewish person. I got to marry a Jew. So every Jew you see, oh my gosh, that could be the one. This could be the one I'm waiting for. Boom. This could be my soulmate. Stop with all the drama. Save it for the movies.
Save it for the movies. No, it's, I think it's, it. The thing, I mean, I know when I've gone out, it's all, I always ask myself a few questions. One of them is predominantly, do I want to know more?
Yeah, that's the question.
Do I want to know more?
That is the question and the only
I've spent 2-3 hours. We've done at least part one of the information download, right? Where you do the information download.
And also, that's also, don't do the information download. Make it a play date. Be fun. Be spontaneous, be creative, be vulnerable. If you're gonna do an information download, you're not gonna get anywhere. There's gotta be a play element to it. There's gotta have fun. I mean, I do this session with this very well-known doctor in Jerusalem. His name is Dr. Asael Romanelli. And we do this thing called the therapist and the rabbi. We have these online sessions every 2 weeks. And one of the things that he talks about a lot is that you gotta be vulnerable in the dating process, and you have to turn it not into a date, but a play date. And I think in the religious world, we are so conditioned to like, everything's gotta be perfect. I gotta have everything perfect and everything's gotta be just so and just so. And as a result, we become stiff instead of fun, and we're not showing our true self. Well, guess what? A relationship that starts from something that's fake, eventually it's just gonna go down the rabbit hole of fakeness, and it's just gonna die because you can't keep up that facade. So why don't you just start from a real place, have fun, enjoy it, and see if you enjoy each other's company.
Right. I think it's super interesting to think about it that way, as well as thinking, you know, right, you mentioned play dates. Think about the activities that you do as a child, like from ages 5 to whatever, at an age that you don't get too cool, but say it's till whatever, 18 as a kid, whatever it is, those same activities for the goal of having fun. Mini golf, bowling, Dave and Buster's, those are all things that you're excited to do as a kid. And then those are often often places people go to get out of their comfort zones. And
absolutely.
Have fun. And those absolutely. Are, maybe that's been, and I, you know, thinking back now, I've never done that. So thinking back to my own approach, reevaluating shouldn't just be an information download. It's about how to, and the best way to organically get that information. And truth be told, we're actually really bad messengers. We don't with our words all the time say the way, really give out who we are, right? It's sometimes it's, you're getting to your own head, you're too calculated. You're like worried if I say something, do something, all that stuff gets in your head. Sometimes you just have to let it act naturally. And the fear of it, like, you know, ending the relationship, well, that's actually a good thing, right?
Just let it be, let it happen. My gosh, what's such a big, you know, it's not so existential, just let it happen. I remember on my third date with my wife, she destroyed me in air hockey. She destroyed me in air hockey. And believe me, I was trying. It wasn't like I was just trying to, you know, like these guys are like, oh, you know, and I admit it, I was trying. She destroyed me. And I don't know, I saw a certain side of her there that, I mean, like, I don't know, there was like a certain like love attraction there in that moment while we were playing. And we were just playing a game of air hockey. I mean, right.
It's such an interesting dynamic, right? Of what's going on in each person's head in that moment. You're thinking like, I'm not trying, she's beating me. Then you start trying and it's like, I actually want to win. And then she knows that I'm trying. And then she also is like thinking like, do I need to let him win for his male ego? Or do I just say, I'm somebody who's competitive and I want to win. I want to show all those things that go in. I think it's always easier to say than not, but I think the best way to do it is to act naturally. The more natural and yourself, at least what version you think that yourself is, and to do that way, not necessarily, don't be who you, I guess in a way it's a little inauthentic, but don't be who you want to be who you are in that moment.
That's the point. Be who you are. I mean, I got to a point in that date.
I want to specify it saying, if you're somebody who's bad manners, like, you should already be working on having better manners. Like, there's certain things that obviously.
Well, don't wait to your date to work on having better manners.
Exactly. That's my point being is, like, if, like, oh, don't say, like, oh, I have bad manners, I'm just being myself. It's like, no, like, those are things that you just should know how to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, yeah. I apologize for cutting you off, but I want
to. No, not at all. I mean, and the funny thing is I think back to that date, and at one point, like, I just kept on trying over and over again, and she just kept on destroying me. And that's why, like, I don't know how many games we played, but I was trying. And I don't know, there was a dynamic that happened there, and you have to allow that. I mean, it was a vulnerability, and yeah, there's so much thinking and so much overthinking when you're dating. But at the end of the day, you need to allow yourself to become a little vulnerable. And then that's when the person can influence you. And if that person can influence you, then you're developing the beginnings of a relationship.
I think that's really profound. There's one thing that's been sticking in my mind that I should have asked it earlier. So I'm going to go a little bit. I'm going to rewind a little bit. You mentioned the three components that you need to have: the shot, the matchmaker, the friend, and the mentor. How does one go about developing? Let's say you're somebody who doesn't know if they have those. What are the requirements of each one? Right? How do you identify who the mentor should be, who the friend should be, and what character traits, who should they be in our lives?
I mean, the Mishnah in Avot, in Ethics of Our Fathers, talks about it. And the way that it says something so interesting. It uses, kene lecha chaver, you should buy a friend, acquire a friend. Sometimes you got to buy yourself a friend. And it says that, you know, asay lecharav, you should, asay from the word doing, you should, you know, I guess reach out to a mentor. I mean, you need, the mentor needs to be somebody who you truly trust, who you can be truly open and honest with, and you are not taking their advice into consideration. You're going to do what they say. The friend needs to be someone who you can be truly open and honest with.
The mentor, the mentor is somebody that you're going to do what they say.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can be truly open and honest with, and you'll do what they say. It's not a survey. You're going to do what they say because they know you and they have your best interest in mind. How do you find that person? I mean, there's so many different ways of finding that person. It could be your therapist. It could be your rabbi. It could be a person who you really trust and respect, but they need to know you, and you can't just decide to give them like a version of yourself that may or may not be true. It has to be someone who really knows you through and through. And that doesn't happen when you start dating. You have to work on that now,
right?
Finding that person. And then your friend is also someone who knows you on a different level, on more of a peer level. That's hard. I mean, you know, it could be someone who knows you for years, and it could be someone who doesn't know you for years, but they should at least be, you should be real with them to the best of your ability. And the matchmaker can be anybody.
Right. Got it. No, it's interesting. I mean, it sounds, you know, I have a few issues with some of it, just in terms of like.
Yeah, well, you're probably not somebody who's trusting. I'm not here to get personal, but.
No, feel free. You can get as personal. No, trust issues for sure. Some would say I have trust issues. I would say I try and be like thoughtful about it. I think information is power. And I think who you choose to share information with, it should be held in high esteem. I don't think you should give out. I think you should open up with people that are deserving of, that you need to open up with and are deserving of being open with. And I think for me, at least, that's how I view it. And maybe I also preface this by saying I'm wrong about so many things. So sometimes even if I have a thought, I'm like, oh, it's probably the opposite because I'm wrong so often. Mm-hmm. Especially about my own. Listen, my own method of madness hasn't worked out for me. I'm 25 and single. I mean, I haven't been not necessarily like openly, actively trying to get married.
You're okay, you got some time to go. You're still good.
Exactly. Right. And I accept that, believe that. I'm open to opportunities. I won't say no to opportunities, but for me, I'm in a place in my life where I don't feel like I need to have that right now. So for me, it's a little different and how I go through it. But I know talking to people that have been struggling through the process, right? The people who are going, who've been on tens of dates and are struggling to find it. I know for them, a lot of it plays a large mental toll in how they go through their process. And some people don't go through any process at all and find it without any of those requirements. So it's just, not all of it's, it's not an exact science by any means at all. It really isn't. So some, but some people learn the wrong lessons from the right results, I think is where I end on it. That wasn't necessarily
the best is the best teacher, right?
What is
experience?
If you learn the right lessons from it.
Yeah. Good point.
Sometimes the right experience is actually can be an actually a poor teacher. If you don't take, if you don't learn from that experience, right? At the end of the day, it's like, oh, go experience the world. Well, you need to open yourself to those experiences, but you also have to think about, you know, what do I learn? What am I learning? What am I taking away from my date, right? If you're somebody who's going on a lot of dates and the breakup happens for the same reasons over and over again, then there's information to take back, right? Then there's actually things you can learn from. But sometimes I always go back to baseball. You know, in baseball, if you hit one out of every three pitches, you're actually a success. In basketball, from the free throw line, if you don't hit at least 8 out of every 10, you're actually doing poor. But in matchmaking, you're looking for one. And now there's tons of arguments of how many, some people believe there's only one person in the world from there. I don't subscribe to that. I think that there's more than one person.
That's putting a lot of pressure. Exactly. Maybe there is only one person in the world, but don't think that way. Because that's putting a lot of pressure on every single person. Maybe this is the one. Stop it. Come on. It's not that complicated.
Don't dramatize it. And the idea of it being one, well, now you're making it a lot harder. But if you're open to multiple people, there are multiple people who can be the one. Maybe there is just one. Some people say there isn't. Regardless of it, the going with that mental process, I think, is a mistake.
Yeah.
I think it hurts more than it helps. And at the end of the day, it's just about figuring out what works for you and how to best get through it all.
Amen.
So to wrap up, I just want to give you the platform right now to any parting thoughts, ideas, things you'd want people to take away, things that we didn't cover.
I mean, there's so many things that we covered that I think are so powerful. I mean, well, how about you know, I always, in my classes and a lot of what I do, I always ask, and I'm going to ask you this question before I do my final thoughts. Sorry that I'm turning the tables on you, but it's often something I do.
No, I love that. I think of this podcast as not just me hosting it, but as the guest, as a co-host. You have as much power in it as I do.
If I were to prompt you by saying, I now know that, ...
I'm not sure, what's the question?
I now know that. Tell me, what do you now know as a result of our conversation?
Oh, what have I learned?
Yeah.
I learned that, it's an interesting question. It takes me a lot of time usually to process these things. I'll have a much more profound answer for you much more profound than in a couple hours, and a different answer in a week, and a different answer in a month. But right now, what I've learned is to really live the serenity prayer. I like it. I think it's a good idea. And I think I've said that for a while now. I've quoted it on a previous episode, probably a few weeks ago. And I've talked about it with other people over the phone and in life, but I haven't been living it to my best of my ability. I can be very calculating, very controlling. And I'm learning that just identifying that problem isn't enough. Identifying and isolating it is two thirds of the trifecta of how we solve problems, right? Identifying, knowing that we have a problem. Now isolating the problem, saying it's in this area and it happens with these things. Now, how do I solve it?
Yeah.
And I've done the first two, and I've done this with a lot. This happens with a lot of things in my life. And now actually doing the work to fixing it is crucial. The first two steps are massive in growth, but you don't actually take that step that you want until you actually do the action.
That's really,
and it's really about controlling, really giving up the control, and also vice versa, really taking control of my life and what I can control. Those are two things that I think
I need to do a better job of. If that was your takeaway, our time today was successful.
I couldn't agree more.
I was watching the Shloshim yesterday for Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of England. It was 30 days since he's passed away, which obviously had a profound impact on many rabbis and many people in the Jewish community and the worldwide community. And his wife, I never actually heard her speak before. And she spoke at the Shloshim, and she ended it off with the statement. She said that her husband once told a story. He said that he had heard of a rabbi that went through the Holocaust and lost his wife and 11 children. And they asked him afterwards, how can you still believe in a merciful God after going through all of that? And they said, do you have no questions of God? And he turned to them and said, of course I have questions of God. My questions of God are so powerful that were I asked them of God himself, God would invite me up to heaven and give me the answers. But then he continued to say, I prefer to be down here on earth with the questions than up there in heaven with the answers.
Whoa.
And I think that if my last words to you is, and I see this in your quest for curiosity, there's always more questions than there is answers in our life. And this, what Elaine Sachs said, quoting her husband, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs, is I think maybe for me it summed up a lot of that questions. I agree with that. I'd prefer to be down here with the questions than up there with the answers.
Yeah, that's something that I'm processing in real time now, and I don't have any coherent thoughts on it. I think there's a lot to unpack with that answer, taking everything that she gave that was going on in her life into it, as well as
absolutely
taking it on and reflecting on it in my own life. So I'll save some face and really just try and think more about that before speaking on it. That's a really powerful thought and idea, I think everybody will understand that differently,
yeah,
which is the beauty in it.
I think that it's okay to live with uncertainty.
And I think that's where somebody who's dealt and still deals with a lot of anxiety, I think that's the number one rule is figuring out is not trying to quash it completely, but it's learning to deal with it and to accept it for what it is and what it isn't, understanding it and just being okay with it. So I think that's an unbelievable idea. And where can we find you to hear more about you, to learn more about you? Where can we find you?
Find me on all the socials. On Facebook, I'm at My Rabbi. On Twitter, at Montreal Rabbi. On Instagram, at Montreal Rabbi. You can find me at theloverabbi.com, where I have a lot of stuff. I also have three podcasts.
Wow.
That you can follow as well. I try to make myself as available as possible. If you put my name, Rabbi Yisrael Bernath, into Google, something's going to come up.
Awesome. I'll throw all your tags and all the places to find you in the show notes below on the episode. And I can certainly attest to that. I mean, I reached out to you a couple of weeks ago. We set up and hopped on a call only a few minutes later. And here we are after, by happenstance, running, meeting each other almost about a year and a half ago on that Wild Pesach program. So where we both worked unbelievably harder than we thought we would. And that's how this conversation came to be, which is like the best part about doing this podcast is you never know who you're going to get to speak to. So Rabbi, thank you so, so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
It's really an honor to be here today. And David, keep up the good work. You're doing good stuff. I'm a big fan.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you so much to Rabbi Bernath for coming onto the podcast. If you want to check out Rabbi Bernath, you can find him on Facebook at The Love Rabbi, his Instagram page at Montreal Rabbi, his website, www.theloverabbi.com, or his podcasts, The Love at The Love Rabbi. If anybody out there is interested in coming onto the podcast to share your story about how you've dealt with mental health challenges or your thoughts and feelings and emotions about it, please reach out to me. You can find me at don'tworryaboutitpodcast@gmail.com, my Instagram page, Don't Worry About It Podcast, or my Facebook page by the same name, Don't Worry About It. If everybody out there could please do me a favor and subscribe and rate and review the podcast. If you have any open and honest, constructive criticism out there about things that I could do better, please let me know. I'm working on it. I'm trying to get better. I'm really excited about the future of this podcast. A lot of the upcoming guests that I'm going to be having on, I think, are helping me take the next step in this podcast to evolve it, to make it better. And I'm really grateful for all you guys for being part of this journey. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you next week.